listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In our continuing coverage of the U.S. attempt at regime change in Venezuela, we speak today with an internationally known human rights attorney and law professor who happens to live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dan Kovalik. He was an observer of the 2018 presidential election that was won by the sitting president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. He's also an author of several books, his most recent, The Plot to Control the World. We spoke with him via Skype from Pittsburgh on Monday.
Dan Kovalik, you have a special understanding and great experience with and around Latin America, particularly Central America, and perhaps I think that would be very useful for this conversation about Venezuela. So maybe you could start with your understanding of the facts on the ground in Venezuela and then, you know, contextualize that with some of the other things that you know and have learned over the years.
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, I think folks have to keep in mind the fact that, in fact, today's the 20th anniversary, believe it or not, of the Chavista Bolivarian Revolution.
That's right.
So Hugo Chavez was elected to power.
Right.
That's often misunderstood. You often hear that he came to power through a coup, which is not true. He was elected president.
That's right.
And was inaugurated 20 years ago.
Right.
And for the first of all, two things are important to point out. Really, from the day he was elected, the U.S. Moved to get rid of him and moved to undermine the Bolivarian project in many ways. Despite this fact, Chavez was very successful in eradicating poverty, extreme poverty, making Venezuela a much more equal society, and frankly, helping elevate minorities who had been really invisible prior to the Chavista revolution. And I'm talking about indigenous groups and Afro-Colombians. A lot of times people don't even know that there's a sizable Afro-Venezuelan population there.
You know, can I, while we're here, I'd like to take people really to the beginning. If you could do a very brief description of the conditions that existed in 1998 when the presidential election was held, and then maybe some, you know, just outline of what Chavez had promised to remedy, so that we can see these things, how they've been fulfilled, more or less.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, when Chavez took over, you had a country that was ruled really on behalf of the wealthy minority of that society. The thing that led to the rise of Chavez was something called the Caracazo in 1989. It's interesting because the Caracazo happened the same year as Tiananmen Square, which everyone remembers. We commemorated every so often. We commemorated the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. Well, the Caracazo, the estimates of people who died in that were equal in number to those estimated to have died in Tiananmen Square. Somewhere, you know, it's a wide gap, but somewhere between 300 to 3,000 people were said to have died in both of those incidents. And of course, Venezuela is a much smaller country, so Right. Those kind of numbers mean a lot more. But the Caracazo was a massacre against the poor of Venezuela who had risen up against the rise in oil prices, which very much like the Yellow Vest movement in France was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for the poor in Venezuela. They were just tired of living without dignity and living in squalor. And this was the straw that broke the camel's back. And they rose up against this. And again, hundreds to thousands were killed in this. And this was the really enigmatic event in Venezuela, which they remember there. And again, which is not even known to most people in this country. And you had people living in squalor in the barrios of Venezuela. And when Chavez was elected president, he really moved quickly to try to improve the conditions of the vast number of poor in the barrios of Venezuela in many ways, trying to and successfully bringing them health care to the barrios, including through the Cuban doctors who he brought in by bringing them electricity, water for the first time, building these ski lifts up to the barrios so that they didn't have to walk down, you know, these steep mountains to get into the center city. They could take these beautiful ski lifts, which I've taken, which are just gorgeous and they're free. And again, he did a lot to really cut into the poverty and extreme poverty rate of Venezuela. The other thing both he and Maduro have done is build housing for the poor, about 2.5 million units, which is quite incredible for a country of 30 million people. So if you assume a family of four times 2.5 million,
right,
that's what? 10 million.
That's a huge
third
chunk
of the country.
That's exactly right. And not for nothing, folks, about 1.5 million of that 2.5 million have been built since Chavez passed. In other words, by Maduro, this, you know, devil and incompetent guy. 1.5 million units.
Yes. So it's really incredible. Now, the other thing, again, the folks need to remember in terms of thinking about the U.S.'s commitment to democracy, for example, in Venezuela, is that in 2002, the U.S. supported, helped instigate, and immediately recognized a coup regime in Venezuela, in which Hugo Chavez, who was the duly elected president, and this is only 3 years after his initial inauguration, he was kidnapped, taken to an island, and the opposition, with U.S. support and immediate recognition, threw out the Venezuelan constitution, which had just been created through referendum in Venezuela, abolished the Supreme Court, abolished the National Assembly, and fired the Attorney General. This was the democratic so-called opposition that the U.S. supported, and they were one of the few countries in the world to recognize this coup government. Chavez, and this is interesting, I always, you know, having been raised Catholic, I love these biblical references. So Chavez was taken, he was kidnapped on Good Friday,
right?
2002.
Yeah, right.
And he was brought back to power with the demand of the poor who came down from the barrios on Easter Sunday.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2002. So,
and on the Christ third day, he rose again.
Yes. Beautiful story. So this kind of sets the context for what's happening now, of course. And by the way, you know, one of the reasons that Nicaragua, or that Venezuela is in the state it's in now, is frankly because I would say Chavez was probably too forgiving to the people who were involved in that coup. He didn't jail many people, and he forgave most of the people who did it. And they have survived to continue to cause problems for that country. But it certainly shows the benevolence of the Venezuelan revolution, which I think, again, people may not understand or appreciate.
Right.
Now, fast forwarding a little, Chavez is very successful in really helping the poor of Venezuela. And then Chavez is diagnosed with cancer, and he dies at the end of 2012, which was a huge blow to the Venezuelan people. Mm. He handpicked Nicolas Maduro to run as his successor. So at this point, Maduro had been named his vice president. Now, the interesting thing, again, to keep in mind is, if this were the United States, as you know, if the president died of cancer or anything, the vice president would simply become president, right?
Right.
That's not the case under the Venezuelan Constitution. So Nicolas Maduro, while being vice president, still had to run for president in April of 2000. I think it was April, but anyways, early 2013 after Chavez died. So the wounds of Chavez dying were very fresh. The people were still reeling from this because Chavez was very beloved. And now they have to organize and go to the polls to vote for president. And Nicolas Maduro was elected president at that time in a very narrow vote. I was there at the time. And it was a nail biter.
Squeaker, yep.
Yeah, he won by around, I think, 1% or something against barely. A candidate named Henry Capriles.
Right.
But he won. And it was in very shortly after, in 2014, that the U.S. really starts to ratchet up its attacks against Venezuela. And what did these attacks look like? So first of all, the U.S. begins to initiate economic sanctions against Venezuela. And the other thing they do, and this is not well known, but there's a very good Independent of London story, the Independent being a newspaper in Britain, did a story on this, that with the connivance of Saudi Arabia, they artificially depressed the prices of oil in 2014. Actually, the main target of this was Russia and Iran.
Yep.
But as, again, the Independent point out, while they were the targets, it devastated Venezuela's economy, which yep. depends on oil. So between the sanctions and the lowering of the oil prices, Venezuela begins to now really struggle to keep its economy afloat and to continue its gains in terms of helping the poor. And that became increasingly more difficult as time went on. And then when Trump is elected in 2016, becomes president in January 2017, he ratchets up the sanctions even further. A big thing he did, there were two things he did. One was he made it impossible for Venezuela to refinance its debt, which all countries do and have to do at times. And this made it very difficult for Venezuela to dig out of its economic hole. And the other thing he did is start to freeze the assets of Citgo, Venezuela's oil company in the U.S., preventing about $1 billion from being sent back to Venezuela from that company every year. Now, as you know, they've announced, Trump's announced that he's going to prevent any of those assets from going back.
And there was also, there was litigation that culminated, there was a court decision back in October, I think, if I remember correctly, federal, that the judgment had already been entered against the government of Venezuela, and so they were attaching assets, Citgo's income and some other things here in this federal court. I remember seeing that go by like October of last year. I haven't looked at Pacer in a long time, and maybe I will to see what the status of it is. But that Venezuela's, you know, lifeblood is this revenue stream, and it's been getting attacked every which way by the U.S. for a good while.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so it really, you know, Venezuela begins then to suffer this real serious economic crisis, which can't be disputed, you know, and then things became very difficult for Venezuela. And what happened also were these indirect results because the U.S. was sanctioning, and this even began under Obama, because the U.S. was levying sanctions against Venezuela, a lot of U.S. companies and some Colombian companies as well, by the way, either because of a fear that they didn't understand the sanctions and therefore weren't willing to take a chance, or because they also wanted to undermine Maduro. Whatever the case was, Venezuela found it hard to essentially obtain needed resources for its people through the free market. So it would try to buy food, for example, or it would try to buy medicine from, you know, private companies, again, in the U.S. and Colombia. And either the companies would simply say no, or there were times they would actually pay the money and the companies simply would not send them the product
right.
they ordered.
Right.
And this was true with insulin that wow. they had bought and with chemo therapy drugs for children, for example, and certainly for food. So, you know, here Venezuela was getting clobbered already by these sanctions. And now, of course, it could not even when it had the money, couldn't spend the money to help its own people.
Right.
And now that's becoming more and more difficult. So, for example, another example of this, you know, really theft is that the Bank of England right now has about $1.5 billion in gold.
Right.
Deposits that Venezuela
right.
deposited with them, as
right.
we would deposit money in a bank. And when we deposit money, we expect it to be given back to us when
right.
we ask for it. Well, the Bank of England is refusing to give them $1.5 billion in gold.
That's right. That's
that
amazing.
Is there.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And so, you know, you have this just economic war against Venezuela, and that's all it can be called, you know. And it's hurting, of course, the most needy in that country. Meanwhile, the people with money, they still can get what they need.
Right.
And it's those people that are pushing for this coup right now. Mm. And so that's really the background of where we're at. And, you know, I think people, you know, need to keep a couple things in mind. I mean, first of all, that, you know, the Chavez-Maduro governments, I believe, have done their level best, you know, to make advancements in terms of social justice in Venezuela and have done a very good job. Now, that doesn't mean they haven't made missteps. I think they have. Of course, they're human beings. They're not perfect. And of course, they've had a lot of obstacles put in their way by the U.S. And so when they've tried to make corrections, that's been difficult because of these sanctions. But even beyond that, I mean, the fact is that last May, Nicolas Maduro stood for election. I was an election observer at that time, by the way. He ran against an opposition candidate from the business community, a guy named Henry Falcone, who was a totally, you know, legitimate opposition candidate, who, by the way, Trump had threatened with sanctions if he ran for election,
right,
which is very interesting.
He ran once before also, and he was one of the two finalists in the opposition, if I remember that correctly, last time.
It's possible. He never was the main nominee, but he might have ran for a small, you know, a smaller party. But in any case, he was the main opposition candidate this time. But Trump threatened him with sanctions if he actually stood for election. And why? Because the U.S. wanted to undermine entirely the legitimacy of those elections. But nonetheless, Falcone did run. A large group of the opposition did abstain from the election. So you had a fairly low voter turnout at 46%, which is low, certainly by Venezuela standards, not terribly low by U.S. standards, by the way, where we have a hard time getting people to come out and vote.
Right.
And out of those 46% of the electorate, 67% voted for Maduro. So, you know, he won. Okay. It's not a resounding mandate given, you know, the percentage of people who voted, but it was legitimate. He is the legitimate president in the same way Trump is the legitimate president, even though he lost by about 3 million votes to Hillary Clinton. Okay.
Yeah, right.
That's our system of government.
No question in Venezuela where the popular vote was. Two-thirds of it went to Maduro. In the United States, that's not the way, you know, that it gets decided under the law. But Trump stands on about a little less than half of about 45% of the electorate, whereas Maduro stands on two-thirds of about 45% of the electorate.
Yeah, exactly. So, so when you constantly hear this refrain in the media that the election was a sham or whatever, that's just not true. It's not true. And in fact, no one even credibly questions the results of that election in terms of the actual vote count. They have a very good electoral system. Jimmy Carter called it the best electoral system in the world. And so no one really questions that about 6 million people voted for Maduro as president. When they say it was a sham, they mean because a lot of people abstained from voting. Well, again, that would make pretty much every U.S. election here a sham, if that's how you would define it. But they never define it in the media here. They never tell you what exactly they're talking about. They simply say he's not the legitimate president and that this Guaido is somehow equally legitimate when he's not. He didn't even run for president, much less was he elected. And so what we have is a situation in which if Maduro is forced out of office under these circumstances by the United States, this would be a travesty. This would be a horrible breach of democracy in Venezuela. It would be a horrible breach for democracy and a defeat for democracy in all of Latin America. I mean, this is old-timey coup-making that the U.S. is engaged in with old-timey coup-makers like Elliot Abrams, who was
Bolton,
you know, jailed for his role in the Iran-Contra scandal, and John Bolton. Right. You know, these are old-time neocons who openly advocate and have worked for regime change around the world. And these are the people who are the prime movers right now in this regime change operation in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And you know what puzzles me a lot is that a lot of people on the left in the U.S., while they know the likes of John Bolton and Elliot Abrams, know these are bad characters. And while they also quite rightly question the intelligence and decency of President Donald Trump, somehow they fail to question when these guys are engaged in a coup in Venezuela. I mean, just like, how did Trump get smart all of a sudden?
I'm looking at what goes through the social media, which is, I guess, the closest I can get. I can't do my own polling, of course, but, you know, it's like no one knows, apparently, out there that the first executive orders, you know, first the imposition of this whole regime of economic warfare, the bulk of that started on either Bush or Obama, and mostly Obama. And this is what was in place when Trump came in. All he did was pile on. And that the same players that they're talking about now, like, oh, they're being fooled, they're going along, were the architects of it back in, 2012, 2014. Pelosi, the whole lot of them. These people are active players in this project. They're not dupes and they're not incompetent. And that's a point that I don't think people really get.
Yeah, actually, and I saw one of the key intellectual authors of this coup was Deborah Wasserman Schultz, of all
people. Okay.
this is a bipartisan effort, as most of these things are, as most foreign policy of the United States is, as bad as it is. It tends to be bipartisan in its banality and evil, and that is absolutely the case here.
Yeah.
I think there's maybe I've counted four Congress people in toto who oppose the regime change operation here.
Yeah.
So it's a terrible thing, and it's even more terrible again that people who should know better are not opposing this. I will assure you that if Maduro goes down in a way that is, abrupt and forced, like the U.S. is trying to do, that you're going to see some type of Pinochet regime take its place. And there's going to be a lot of bloodshed, and a lot of good people are going to be killed, like they were in Chile. And recall that in Chile, Allende was only in power for 3 years.
Yeah.
Here you have a revolution that's been in power for 20.
Yeah.
And so imagine what the coup government would have to do to pull out that revolution by the roots. It would be very ugly.
And then you have a whole other situation going on, too. Over the period from, and I'm going to try to be quick here because we only got about 4 minutes left, but over the period from 1999 until he passed in 2013, Chavez addressed the problems of the poor primarily, and likewise with the revolution since. And there is a huge overlay of race with the poverty that existed there, and a split, more or less, 50-50 if you look at the political split in the country. And so what you would have essentially is half the people who had been treated like slaves, in essence, or worse, for centuries, finally get a taste of the 21st century from the revolution. They take the taste themselves. They march on the palace to protect their president, return the government to him in 2002, and now they're going to be crushed. That is going to create a situation. I can't imagine what that's going to do in Brazil, for example. There's going to be huge echoes of that around the world.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. And it does send a message throughout the world that and it's the message the U.S. has been trying to send to the world for over 100 years. And that is, especially if you're in the global south and you try to take your own fate into your own hands and you try to build a more equal and just society, you will be punished. And that's exactly the message the U.S. is trying to send here.
Right. So this past weekend, however, there's a little dissonance with that particular broadcast. The dueling rallies were about From looking at the aerial photography, I'm going to make a rough guess that there were about 10 times as many people supporting the government over the weekend as supporting the usurper. And I'm wondering, it certainly looked like Maduro was felt emboldened from the speech and the really strong support on the street. How do you think that's going to factor?
Well, I think it's an important factor. In the poll that I saw was that about 86% of the Venezuelan people oppose U.S. intervention, and about 81% or so oppose sanctions. So even people who may not support Maduro don't want what the U.S. has planned for them. And I think that is the message here. And I think that that may make a difference and may allow Maduro to survive.
You were going to advise people in the United States in 30 seconds or less how they can help in terms of support, what would you say?
I would say, lobby your Congress people to oppose all forms of U.S. intervention in Venezuela, including sanctions. And also, educate people about this. Write letters to the editor, letters to the editor of your newspaper. Write op-eds. It's important to educate people. The media is so, again, united in support of intervention in Venezuela. It's important to challenge that and question it.
Dan, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Don.
That was the internationally known human rights lawyer and law professor, Dan Kovalik, speaking with us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, this past Monday.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As a presidential candidate, Donald Trump lambasted America's endless and wasteful wars. But as president, he has surrounded himself with individuals who have made defending and advancing American empire a full-time career. Why did Trump cave, and what could be the consequences for him and his presidency? Crosstalking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in New York. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London and author of the book Bombs for Peace. In Dallas, we have Lee Speakerman. He is a U.S. political consultant and policy advisor. And in Auburn, we cross to Jeff Dyson. He is president of the Mises Institute. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. George, let me go to you. It's one of the hallmarks of Donald Trump's foreign policy, maybe not intentional, but is to really be the anti-Obama, to attack Obama's legacy. And we saw that with Bolton going to the Middle East. We saw it recently, and the same thing with Pompeo. But in fact, when you look at the people that have surrounded him, Pompeo, Bolton, the new addition to the team, Elliot Abrams, it seems like more of a combination of the Bush and Obama administration foreign policy. There's nothing really antithetical there. And it seems like when we look at Trump's claim that he does not like foreign interventions, well, he's full geared up in public, steaming ahead for regime change in Venezuela, which, again, is a contradiction to what he ran on. So how do you account for this? Is he held hostage by the deep state? He's indifferent to it? How do you account for it? Go ahead, George.
Well, what Trump did when he, in 2016, and he made his slogan, America First, what he meant by that was that America would rectify the problems that it had been suffering from many years. So he would address the deindustrialization of America, the financialization of the economy. He would address the immigration problem, which has basically driven down wages for many decades. and he would address the growth of China, that China is now becoming the major economic power, potentially much stronger than the United States. And so he had a whole agenda, this was America First, which would end these stupid interventionist wars and improve relations with Russia in the hope of breaking apart the Russia-China alliance. But instead of that, that America First strategy was interpreted by the neocons and the Fox News people as meaning that America does whatever it wants to do anytime it wants to do it without hindrance and without any attempt to consult allies or anything else. And so the John Bolton, the neoconservatives, was a rather a good fit for that, because that's what they assured him. Hey, this is America First. We're just going to go ahead and recognize Jerusalem as capital of Israel. The hell with everyone else. Hey, America First. We Monroe Doctrine. You heard of the Monroe Doctrine? Hey, Venezuela is in our backyard. We can't have Russia and Cuba messing around in our backyard. And then look, Syria. You're just going to let Syria go to the Russians? Hey, this is America First. And I think Trump has reinterpreted America First as a kind of neoconservative full-spectrum dominance of the universe.
Okay, that's very good, interesting analysis. Lee, I saw you were disagreeing there. Go right ahead. Jump in.
Well, I believe, first of all, that a strong United States is much better for the world, for the entire world. We're a force for stability. We're a force for good. And that is very important.
But are foreign interventions good for America? Are foreign interventions good for America? I mean, look at how much money is spent, the lives that are lost. Is that good? Go ahead, Lee.
Hang on. Let me finish. Excuse me. Let me finish here. We are currently undergoing a massive change in policy. What President Trump has put forward, what he campaigned on, and what he's effecting as president is the antithesis of the so-called neocon philosophy. We're reducing our military combat presence in the Middle East. We are not in favor of regime change. What's going on in Venezuela is not imposed regime change. It's the Venezuelan people, through their National Assembly, making regime change. And we are simply supporting that and protecting our diplomats in that country. That is not foreign intervention. The United States is doing what it takes to be strong, to protect the American people, to reinvigorate the American economy. It is working. President Trump is delivering the State of the Union on Tuesday night. The State of the Union globally has never been better for the United States. And what we're doing is not the neocon interventionist approach.
Okay,
it's exactly
then,
the opposite.
So you're saying that Elliot Abrams and John Bolton have had a massive change of heart after careers of forced regime change, okay? I find that very hard to believe. Jeff, you've been listening to the conversation. Jump in.
I think John Bolton and Elliot Abrams would have fit in quite well in an Obama administration or a Hillary Clinton administration. I don't see any huge change here. These are people who believe in an international global order run by America.
No.
And that sounds like America First, but when we get into almost 20 years in Afghanistan, when we get mired in Syria, when it looks like we're getting pulled into Venezuela, perhaps, then people start to say that's not in our interest. And to understand how nonpartisan, how unipolar foreign policies become, just look at the left's reaction to Tulsi Gabbard running for president. I mean, this is the war party in D.C., but if you get outside of D.C., there's no constituency in America for continuing these intractable Middle East wars or getting into new ones in Latin America. I would love to see a policy shift. I think Donald Trump came in without a real Kuwait foreign policy. I think it's great that he campaigned on a America First platform, a non-interventionist platform. He's not governing by that, but he's not the first president to not live up to his campaign promises.
Yes,
I have to strongly disagree with Lee that there's a massive shift. This is a superficial shift while the game stays the same.
Okay, George, I mean, when Trump made the decision to pull out of Syria, you know, both parties, the media, the deep state, everyone did everything in their power to slow that down or even have it revoked. OK, that's what he campaigned on. And if you look at the public opinion right after he made it, after the media barrage, all of the politicians, the deep state, his entire, even his own cabinet, still the public agreed with the president of the United States because that's what he promised to do at running as a candidate. And the same thing with Afghanistan.
There are only 2,000
I haven't finished my question, and this is addressed to George. Well, they're there illegally under international law. Remember that. Go ahead, George, answer my question.
That's
yes, well, that's the thing.
Ridiculous.
But the problem with Trump is that he makes these statements such as, we're pulling out of Syria. We've wasted $17 trillion in the Middle East. That $17 trillion could have been made use of rebuilding America's infrastructure. But he doesn't follow through on this. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't follow through on this because he is basically lazy. Of course, the deep state was going to oppose his policies from start
president
to finish.
Trump,
I mean, of course they were. They were furious
president.
About his election victory. Look, can you let me finish, and I'll and then you can just go on. Of course, they were going to oppose his policies. But what has now happened is that he hasn't delivered on it. He's going to be facing re-election in over a year's time, and the Democrats are going
he's
to
rebuilt
hang
the American
it on
economy
his
and
neck
rebuilt the American
that he
military.
Has not accomplished any
the
of the things that he has
that
said that he would accomplish.
On.
Okay, go ahead. Lee, please don't talk over
ridiculous.
People.
You're totally wrong.
Okay,
you're totally wrong.
Lee, it's your turn.
I'm going to talk over when I hear something crazy.
Well, then, but no
when
one will be able to.
Crazy,
no one will be able to understand what we're saying.
President Trump has rebuilt the American military.
Have a little bit more courtesy.
And rebuilt
go
the American
ahead.
Economy. That is what he campaigned on. He's been extremely, exceedingly, surpassingly effective at that. That is what he campaigned on. He's an effective president. He is not a lazy president. He's talking to foreign leaders all the time. He has made his intentions quite clear. He's had a very clear vision. Rebuild the American economy, reindustrialize the United States, reinvigorate the military, reassert America around the world in the proper way, which he has done. He is reducing our combat presence over the long term. But in a prudent way in the Middle East, which is what he campaigned on and which is what the American people want. So what I've heard, unfortunately, is a lot of hooey.
Look at this, Lee. He has now walked out. Listen, Lee. He has walked out on the INF Treaty. This is a huge treaty that
thank
was
God.
You know,
after
the kind
the
of
Russians
the cornerstone
violated it.
Of
the Russians were violating
era.
It.
Okay.
Gentlemen,
please. I have a rule that we have to have equal time. Jeff, jump in.
ICBMs are the cornerstone.
Please have some
China and Iran are not bound by the INF Treaty.
Jeff, go ahead, please.
If the American electorate was so happy with asserting American dominance,
I'm being courteous, but I don't want our viewers
Hillary would have won. Trump wouldn't have won.
Is not the cornerstone. The INF Treaty is not the cornerstone.
Okay, Jeff, go ahead.
Let me say this.
The
neoconservatives get away with presenting themselves as the adults in the room, as the people who represent real politics, when in fact, they present this kindergarten black and white version of the world where America and the West are noble liberal democracies, and the rest of the world is totalitarianism waiting to happen, a la Maduro, or whoever the demon of the day is. That is actually a very facile.
That goes back to the Monroe Doctrine. That goes back to the Monroe Doctrine. The United States protects Latin America, and we are going to protect democratic regimes.
So what you're saying about Trump's glories are directly opposite of what he campaigned on. And I don't think you can ignore this. I think he campaigned on worrying about America.
He's doing
American
exactly what he campaigned on.
Worrying about the rest of the world. He's allowing
he's
himself,
rebuilt the American military, rebuilt the American
economy. All right, gentlemen,
economy.
I'm going to jump in
he
here. We're going to go to
that's
a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Jeff in Auburn. I mean, you said in the first section of our program here, the adults in the room, and I think that's really interesting because it's I see an enormous amount of continuity from George W. Bush, Obama, and Trump. I see with maybe the exception of Iran, which would be a separate topic. I think it was a huge mistake for the U.S. to walk away from that treaty, and it was the only foreign policy event under the Obama administration that I actually agreed with here. So, you know, Jeff, it seems to me that because there's such a bipartisan consensus, and with the media always modulating it here, it's very and I'm being sympathetic to Donald Trump. I am not attacking him. What he wanted to get accomplished is not being accomplished because he's picked a very bad foreign policy team that's not enacting what he says. They're enacting what they want it to mean, as George said in the beginning of the program. Go ahead, Jeff.
Look, these people hate Donald Trump's guts. They think he's unfit to be president temperamentally, intellectually, morally. Jennifer Rubin, Max Boot, David Frum, these are the people with whom John Bolton and Elliot Abrams agree. Donald Trump is literally shooting himself in the foot almost by appointing these people. The reason he's doing it is because, as cantankerous as he is, he also craves acceptance and approval. When he dropped the famous MOAB in Afghanistan, yeah, just a few months into his administration, I think it was April 2017, he was praised by all sides of the media, including the vicious Washington Post, New York Times. This is how you get to be viewed as a great president. You listen to neocons and start wars that last forever, okay? Part of Donald Trump wants to be a war president. That's the only explanation I can think of that allows him to bring these people in who have violently opposed him, who would have been fit in fine in the Hillary Clinton administration, and now they're running him around by the nose because he wants to appear presidential. I just don't get it, because in every other sense,
Peter,
he's happy to fight with the powers that be.
May I speak up on that, please?
Sure, go ahead. Lee, jump in.
Peter, I totally disagree with that. Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are two of the smartest, most able diplomats that we've ever had at the top levels in the United States. We are very lucky to have them. They both have a terrific personal rapport with President Trump. They're meeting with him privately all the time. There's a great relationship. And the only thing that is analogous to previous presidents is that John Bolton has modeled the structure after what George H.W. Bush had, President George H.W. Bush, who we recently lost, and I don't think anybody will find fault with his foreign policy.
Okay.
It was exceedingly effective.
I will.
Okay.
I model
that John Bolton is using.
Okay, let me
finish my point.
So, Lee,
this thing about adults in the room, I'm sick.
Okay,
it is a very trite saying. Adults in the room, we have a tremendously effective Secretary of State, a tremendously effective National Security Advisor, and a president with a very clear vision who is an active when he campaigned on, which is rebuilding the American military, reasserting our role
right,
in the
Lee,
world without intervention and
you've
regime
made
change,
your point.
Rebuilding
now,
the American
let me
economy.
Ask you another question, but John Bolton doesn't have any responsibility for probably the biggest foreign policy mistake in American history was the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. He just skates away from it. All these other people do the same. Elliot Abrams was convicted of lying, of perjuring himself, and he got a pardon. Again, the same group of people never take responsibility. George, jump in.
That was a political prosecution.
Yes.
Go ahead, George.
Absolutely. And the fact is
Donald Trump could have
Donald Trump could have appointed a pretty decent team of realist foreign policy intellectuals. He could have appointed Stephen Cohen, Andrew Bacevich, Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer. There is a series of foreign policy intellectuals who were on his wavelength, who did indeed think that America should not be in the business of regime change, interventionism,
Trumpism antagonizing Russia. Instead, he has gone with the neocon team. John Bolton is the man who persuaded George W. Bush to walk out of the ABM treaty. And what does he do now? What does he do now? He persuades Donald Trump to walk out of the INF treaty. This, you know, few things have done more to destroy relations with Russia and to fuel the new Cold War as that withdrawal from the ABM treaty. And now we've got the INF treaty withdrawal. I mean, if you want good relations with Russia, it's a very strange way to go about it.
Okay, Jeff, let me go to Alburn here. Jeff, kind of...
Well, Russia needs to do its part. Okay, Russia needs to do its part.
I'm talking to Jeff right now. Please, Lee, okay? Jeff, I mean...
Yeah, but stop undermining Ukraine. Stop,
okay, you know, but you're filibustering
stop collaborating
because...
with Iran, the world's greatest terror sponsor.
No, that's just talking
Russia
points.
Needs to do its part.
Those are the usual talking points and doesn't really get to the point of what
we're talking
about.
Talking points.
Jeff, is this really kind of a very strange marriage of Bolton's unilateralism and what Donald Trump thinks is American first? Is this kind of a fusion of the two? Because that's the only way I think it could work. Go ahead, Jeff.
That's a good thing.
Neoconservatives are entrenched.
It's a good
They're
fusion.
Entrenched across media. They're entrenched across both political parties, and they're convinced that they alone know what's right and what's best for American foreign policy. And I'm not saying that they're all ill-intentioned. I think they're well-intentioned. They honestly believe that people in Auburn, Alabama should be fretting about Iran sending an intercontinental ballistic missile our way. I mean, frankly, I worry a little bit more about my kids and my mortgage and things like that. So they're not the adults in the room. They're not part of Trump's vision, certainly not the one he ran on. Someone like Rand Paul, frankly, who I'm sure drives Lee ballistic, is someone who's much closer to Trump's original vision. We have serious domestic debt problems in this country, serious entitlement shortfalls. It's going to be an absolute catastrophe for a population above 65 that's growing rapidly.
Trump is dealing with that.
And to be talking
economic
about Russia,
growth
which is shrinking at every border, its population is shrinking, to be talking about Iran, all of these things are diversions. They get us away from Trump's domestic agenda. And frankly, I think that the people who are spouting this stuff
Iran being a nuclear threat is not a diversion.
They don't pay
the
price.
That's the greatest threat on the world stage. That's not a diversion.
Well,
nuclear Iran is not a diversion. I'm sorry.
Okay, after
kind of important.
Well,
Russia needs to stop collaborating with
Iran. The Pentagon has repeatedly said that there
is
no evidence that Iran is building a bomb. That's a myth.
They are aiding the number one state sponsor of terror in the world.
Okay, well, a lot of people in the world think the other countries like the United States are the biggest sponsor of terror in the world here. Okay, you're wasting your time with this ridiculous talking points.
That's comedic.
George,
I didn't know this was a comedy show.
Okay, but you're making a comedy out of people that are trying to discuss real issues that are not discussed in the mainstream media, as George has pointed out in this program.
Calling the U.S. the number one sponsor of terror is comedy.
All right, you've been able to say it. You've already said it a few times. I hope you're satisfied. Can we move on? Because we're not talking about that. We're talking about Donald Trump's foreign policy. George, do you think that U.S. troops will ever withdraw from Syria, even after the president has demanded it? Do you think, and would this be a diplomatic defeat for him? Because the trust in the United States and the Middle East, if the president can't get his own troops out, what does that message send?
I don't think the U.S. troops will withdraw from Syria because I don't really think that he has the will or the energy or the decisiveness to do it. And that's just shown by the fact he made his announcement and then he allowed everyone else to push him away from his policy. Same with Afghanistan. He promised to withdraw from Afghanistan, but he quickly allowed himself to be pushed into staying on. And as I said earlier, he will face re-election, and the Democrats will point out that you have failed in all of your foreign policy goals.
You don't rush into it.
You have failed to withdraw any of your forces, and you have failed to improve relations with Russia. You're into an arms race, and I think that's going to sink his presidency.
Okay, Jeff.
Russia is collaborating with Iran.
We're rapidly running out of time, Jeff.
They are developing new weapons. They are violating the INF Treaty.
Okay, well, both countries have walked away from it, so it's a dead letter. Why are we discussing it? It's over, okay? Now we have to face the consequences, an arms race. Jeff, let me go to you. Let's talk about Venezuela. It seems to me that Trump is walking into a trap. Because if it does go sideways, well, it's his fault, okay? They've set it up in such a way that no matter what decision he makes, he's a foreign policy failure. I believe in his gut, he doesn't want to be saddled with a foreign intervention that could go wrong, and it very likely will go wrong, a la Bolton and Elliot Abrams. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, they just took it upon themselves unilaterally to start treating the National Assembly leader as a legitimate president, a guy who never ran for anything. Look, it's hard to gauge the support for Maduro. It's hard through Western media to understand what the feeling in the street is. Obviously, there's a humanitarian crisis there. That's far more important. Do we want to be involved in a Latin American civil war? Is that what it would take to oust Maduro? I don't know. But
it's
I do think
Monroe
we ought to be
doctrine.
Asking these questions, and
we
I think
are,
that
we are going to, when the people have elected a National Assembly, we are going to stand behind
itself,
that, not an autocrat, not a dictator.
Country, military intervention generally follows.
Okay, so Lee, it's all about hang on here, Lee, it's all about democracy because Bolton said it was all about oil. He said it on Fox News. He said it's about oil.
Well, all I know is it's President Trump, with his foreign policy team, with Secretary of State Pompeo, with Bolton, led almost the entire world to back the Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela.
Only 20 countries do. Only 20 countries recognize it. That's not the entire world. It's 20 countries.
Congress agrees with that. That was a triumph. And it goes back to the Monroe Doctrine. The United States is not going to countenance the suppression of the people's will, authoritarian governments. We are
okay, Lee, the next program we're going to do all of the military interventions the United States have committed against the Western Hemisphere. That'll be a very long program. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Dallas, and in Auburn. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.